This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Catherine Franke about her new book, Wedlocked: The Perils of Marriage Equality.
As she says, be careful what you wish for.
We'll remember radical attorney Liz Fink, a member of the National Lawyers Guild, by listening to some clips from her memorial ceremony.
She was really one of a kind, and you'll see when you listen to what people said about Liz and what Liz said about herself.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, we've had Professor Stephen Salida on several times over the past 2 years, I think. And we have, I understand, a victory at long last.
A tremendous victory, Heidi. A year and a half ago, when he was getting ready to move to Champaign-Urbana and assume the position of a tenured professor in the American Indian Studies program, they let him go for his tweets criticizing the Israeli slaughter in Gaza.
Before he even got on campus, right?
He'd made all the arrangements, quit his job, gave up his home, and was about to drive across the country to take up his new job when the Israelis killed 500 and some children in Gaza and 1,500 other people. Salida, who had been a longtime activist in the BDS movement, tweeted some really unflattering and vulgar things about Netanyahu. And for that, without any kind of democratic consultation at the university, the chancellor
no
just...
No hearing, no due
nothing,
process.
No, nothing, nothing, zero. They just fired him. Well, now we understand that he's won a victory. We don't know the extent of it yet.
In court, he sued.
Well, he started a lawsuit,
right.
And the university was under such pressure. 5,000 academics were boycotting them. The American Association of University Professors condemned them. 15 different departments at the university voted no confidence in the chancellor, who was also dismissed for secretly sending out emails trying to avoid any kind of public disclosure. Anyways, tremendous scandal. The University of Illinois was a prestigious university, and now there's a big cloud hanging over it. So I think that the Board of Trustees decided that the better part of their strategy here would be to just give up. And they agreed to settle the lawsuit. Now, will Stephen get his job back? How are they going to compensate him? Is he going to be allowed to talk about this? I mean, all those details we'll know on the 12th when the Board of Trustees meets in an open meeting that's going to be broadcast on the web. So stay tuned. This case shows that the usual Palestinian exception to the First Amendment no longer obtains in the case of Stephen Salida.
While the movement for marriage equality by the LGBT rights community has been a leading civil rights issue of the 21st century, it's not the first movement seeking the right to marry. Slaves who were freed in the 1860s also organized for, and ultimately won, that right to marry at the end of the Civil War. As Professor Catherine Franke argues in her new book, Wedlocked: The Perils of Marriage Equality, tying the definition of free and equal citizenship so intimately to the institution of marriage presents its own set of problems. In Wedlocked, Professor Franke meticulously compares firsthand accounts of African American struggle for freedom and civil rights with lessons for today's marriage equality movement. This association offers two lessons. First, be careful what you wish for, as the backlash against new rights holders may set back the larger cause for equality. And second, the two movements for marriage rights may help expose the differences between racism and homophobia. Catherine Franke is the Isidore and Seville Sulzbacher Professor of Law at Columbia Law School, where she directs the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. She is among the nation's leading scholars in the area of feminism, sexuality, and race, and is the chairperson of the board of directors at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Catherine Franke, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's so nice to be with you again.
Congratulations on Wedlocked, The Perils of Marriage Equality. It's a wonderful book. We wanted to start by asking, what is it about marriage that's made it a suitable vehicle for elevating the civil status of gay people? And why hasn't marriage played the same role for African Americans in this country?
Well, that's the central question of the book. It's a complicated question with a complicated answer. I have to say that it's something that has surprised me in writing this book, that marriage has been such a successful vehicle for rebranding homosexuality. And as I say in the book, marriage has been a way for gay people to take the sex out of homosexuality and for us to be rendered less perverse and more decent people. I never thought that was our goal when I first came out, not a few steps from here at Stonewall and in the Village in the 1970s. But part of why I think marriage has been so successful as a campaign in the courts and in the hearts and minds of Americans is that it's basically a very conservative thing to ask for. Gay people are not interested, or same-sex couples are not interested in blowing up the institution of marriage, which was certainly our feminist project years ago. We regarded it as a sexist, elitist institution that was about rendering women property and preserving male property. But that's not the critique of marriage now at all within the gay community. Indeed, marriage is seen as a way to preserve the security and the normality of same-sex couples. And we've persuaded, or the marriage campaign, I believe, has persuaded the courts and the public more generally that this is the time and that same-sex couples are deserving of that kind of dignity. And so this is the register of the same-sex marriage movement, is that marriage dignifies deserving couples. And unfortunately, the negative consequences of that is that it leaves a kind of remainder, if you will, a kind of leftover of undignified families and undignified couples and people who perhaps are deserving of social shame and that are thus not entitled to the blessings of marriage. And unfortunately, in this country, that remains largely people of color.
The subtitle of Wedlocked is How African Americans and Gays Mistakenly Thought the Right to Marry Would Set Them Free. Let's talk about that, because you really have some poignant stories about African Americans during the Civil War and right after. Of course, they weren't legal subjects then, so they had no rights whatsoever, including the right to marry, but they got that, and it turned out to be kind of a mixed blessing, and I wanted to ask you about that. I had a vision of you sitting in some dusty library basement somewhere in the South coming up with these records, and that's really one of the great parts of the book, and I wanted to ask you about these disappointments.
Well, Michael, it's funny you mentioned that. I could have included in the book some pictures I have of myself on the courthouse steps in Vicksburg, Mississippi, with a young man who was a Civil War reenactment performer in his wool Confederate uniform. So the Civil War, in a way, is still alive and well in some parts of the South.
Especially Vicksburg.
Well, yeah, it certainly is. But what I found there were boxes and boxes in the attic of the old courthouse in Vicksburg of criminal cases where African-American people were prosecuted for bigamy or adultery. And I went to find those boxes because I was curious what marriage meant for newly freed people at the end of the Civil War. I thought there might be some lessons for same-sex couples today about what it means to use marriage or turn to marriage as a vehicle for equality and citizenship. And it turns out there are quite a few important lessons that I got from those cases.
Catherine, specifically talking about slaves, what did they hope would come from marriage? Was it a mainstreaming?
No, not at all. You know, enslaved people are not humans, they're property. And so as property, they were unable to legally marry. You know, a chair can't marry a table in the same way that enslaved people can't marry. It's an offensive concept, of course, because the institution of slavery is highly, highly offensive. So when black people were freed, they became human, legally human, and thus entitled to marry for the first time. And so the ability to turn to law And exercise rights was hugely important for people who had been treated so horribly for so long. And marriage was particularly important because of a desire to secure their families. When black people were enslaved, of course, they would marry practically. They would marry in front of God, in front of their community, but they were not legally married. And as a result, their owners would sell away their spouse, their children. And they may get married several times in their communities and have several husbands or wives. And at the end of the war, those complicated families sought to find one another and reconstitute themselves. And so the institution of marriage was hugely important for people to feel that they had some family security that they never had had before. And we hear that echo today. Not that, of course, gay people were worried about being treated the way that slaves were. I don't want to at all say that those things are the same. But that marriage provides security, financial and legal security for our families today is part of what's motivated the marriage equality movement, just as it did the turn to marriage in the 19th century for black people.
But let's pick up again on a thought you just expressed about the lessons that one might draw from the experience of African-American people subsequent to the war, once they were freed and could marry. What kind of lessons did you tease out of all of that?
Well, there were many. There were many. So the first, I would say, is that many freed people believed that the freedom to marry meant they can organize their lives however they wanted. They could pick a spouse. Perhaps they could pick more than one spouse. As I said, their families were very complicated. Many people loved more than one spouse and had children with more than one spouse. And so they thought, let's put together more collective families than just one husband and one wife. They learned quite quickly that that was not allowed, that marriage had rules, and you had to comply with those rules if you wanted to exercise the right to marry. And the punishment for that was rather severe. So when people didn't follow the rules of marriage, mostly black men found themselves prosecuted for bigamy or adultery very quickly after the end of the war. And both those crimes were felonies, so of course that would disenfranchise them. They would lose a right to vote. They would go to prison and then became subject to an emerging convict leasing system where white planters turned to prisoners, black prisoners, to do the agricultural work that enslaved people had done before. Being a leased convict to do farm or labor work was more dangerous and more deadly for black men than was doing labor agricultural work under slavery. So the parallel or the lesson I learned for that today is that over many, many years in the gay community, we've had complicated family and kinship arrangements. We didn't always pick just one person to love or one person to have sex with or one person to raise a family with. We would do so in complicated kinship relationships. That's part of what we celebrated in the gay community. And we're losing that to some degree. We're losing a more creative and open way of thinking family and taking up the nuclear family instead.
You alluded to this in the beginning, but I'd like to hear more about why progressive queers are ambivalent about marriage.
Well, I think we all know that the institution of marriage is irresistible for many people, not only for the romance of the idea of being married or the acceptance that your family may give you once you marry your partner, but also for the legal and economic benefits that marriage brings with it. And so as people of my generation in our 50s and moving into our 60s are looking at estate planning, are looking at our retirement, are looking at how we're going to support ourselves when we get older, marriage becomes a pretty important way of creating security among the couple, but also to inherit Social Security benefits and to think about who will inherit your property when you die. So if you're unmarried and you leave your property, whether it's a house you own together or your savings, to someone to whom you're not married, it's as if you're giving it to a stranger. And it gets taxed at a very high rate. If you're married, you can pass those assets to your spouse tax-free. So it is irresistible. But what I've offered to readers in this book, at the end of the book, is a progressive call to action for married queers. So this is an 8-point plan for those of you out there who sort of held your nose and succumbed to your lawyer or your accountant or other people in your life who said you're really crazy if you don't get married because you're financially and legally vulnerable if you don't, how do you hold on to your politics and still get married. Because I have to say, my partner and I are the only people in our social circle who've been together for a few years, we've been together 10, who have not married. All of our friends have married and have done so somewhat ambivalently, I have to say, but they felt like it was irresponsible not to. And I think, you know, I don't want to judge their decisions, just as I hope they won't judge ours. So this 8-point plan gives you political objectives that you can stay true to. Like, don't collaborate in the repeal of domestic partner benefit programs. Keep defending them. We ought to have a range of ways that people can organize their private lives, their family lives, including marriage, but certainly other kinds of family forms. And then I just want to jump to the last one that relates to something I said a moment ago about complex families. Last week, I got an email from a friend inviting me to contribute financially to the retirement of a longtime friend of ours who has been a devoted political activist for her entire life. She has no retirement, and she's aging, and hopefully at some point might retire, although knowing her, she may go to her grave doing political work. And this friend is inviting us to contribute to her retirement. I'm not in love with her. She's not my family. But she's part of my political family and my larger sense of kinship. So I made a substantial gift to her retirement. And I think that the idea of marriage and the tax advantages that come with it create this idea of preferred family and then people that have become invisible to you. And I'd like us to keep the spirit in the gay community, but also in the progressive straight community, that we all need to take care of each other, not just our spouses.
I'm curious about your students, Catherine, and do you discuss this topic with them? What are their thoughts?
I have actually assigned one chapter of the book to my students last year in my gender justice classes. I gave them the first chapter on Kentucky and what happened in Kentucky when President Lincoln was trying to conscript black soldiers into the Union Army. And the students read the chapter, and it's mostly told through the voices of formerly enslaved black men and black women, and it testifies to the outrageous violence that these men and women experienced from slave owners when they left the plantations, the men to join the army and the women to join their husbands. And the first thing the student said to me was, "I wish you had issued a trigger warning before you had had us read this." Now, I'm not a big fan of trigger warnings, but that's a subject for another show, and I'm happy to come back and talk to you about it.
We had that show, actually, last month.
Well, then I'd ask your listeners to go back and listen to that show. But the students, first of all, I think are woefully uneducated about the history of the Civil War and about emancipation and what happened at the immediate end of the Civil War. And I also think that the marriage equality movement today is largely decontextualized from other social justice movements today, let alone in the past. So connecting the dots between gay rights and other civil rights, particularly for African Americans today, is part of what I'm trying to do in this book, and to show that marriage has a racial history in general, but also in particular with the kinds of arguments that have been made in the marriage equality cases, unfortunately, I think, have had the effect of reinforcing racism and particularly the disadvantage of single parents in the black community.
What did you find wrong with the logic that got us to the rights of gay marriage?
Well, one thing I want to clarify for your listeners and more generally is that I don't oppose the marriage equality in general. I think it is wrong for the state to exclude same-sex couples from marrying, and the reason I think it is wrong is because they hate us. It's a form of state-sponsored homophobia, and we should just call it that. We should call it out just as other policies like limiting the vote is a form of state-sponsored racism. And limiting reproductive rights is a form of state-sponsored sexism. So part of what I found problematic about the way in which the marriage equality cases have been argued is that we made a turn to dignity. And dignity was the lead argument that the advocates made in the Supreme Court, largely because they were appealing to Justice Kennedy. As you know, almost any civil rights or important case these days that's argued before the Supreme Court is really only argued to one person, and that's Justice Kennedy. He brings a kind of liturgical or religious fervor to the idea of gay rights that has delivered in the gay rights cases, but done so in a way that I think is somewhat dangerous. So rather than declaring that excluding same-sex couples from the institution of marriage is a form of heterosexist hatred against gay people, instead we won the case because Justice Kennedy said that not allowing us to marry humiliates us. And humiliates children because their families should be dignified like other families, and that the blessings of marriage are something that should be conferred upon those couples that deserve it. So that same-sex couples are now deserving of the dignity of marriage, thereby kind of leaving on the table that others are not. And so what the marriage equality movement has turned into is a marriage rights movement rather than a sexual rights movement or a gay rights movement. And if we look at the case that advocates often point to, the Loving versus Virginia decision, where the Supreme Court found that laws that prohibit white people from marrying people of another race are unconstitutional, the court there said that what's wrong with those laws is that they embody white supremacy. White supremacy, I mean, that is an incredibly powerful political term that the Supreme Court had never used before and has never used again. And I think our challenge could have been to get the court to use the word homophobia and hatred of gay people. In this case, in the marriage equality cases today, just like they did in Loving versus Virginia, rather than turning to dignity, as we did in appealing to Justice Kennedy.
And Catherine, is there a movement to sort of bring forth these issues, or are you in the minority of thinking?
Well, I regretfully am in the minority, but it's a substantial minority. There remain many of us within the LGBT community, but not only. There are plenty of progressive allies more broadly who still have a critique of the institution of marriage and worry about the way in which we've invested and indeed kind of rehabilitated marriage through the marriage equality movement today. So there are plenty of us who have a much broader agenda in mind, who are concerned about those who can't or won't marry, and also are worried about the way in which we distribute important essential social benefits through marriage. I mean, one should be able to get health care, one should be able to get Social Security, one should be able to have some level of well-being, regardless of who you're married to. And part of what we do with marriage is distribute benefits because we don't have a social safety net in this country. And that more progressive economic justice or welfare critique of the way that we order society here is absent from that marriage equality debate.
Catherine, you write that gays, in your words, have been able to escape the curse of Sodom, but blacks have not been able to escape the curse of Ham. What are those two curses, and why is that so?
Well, these are biblical references. I'm not a scholar of the Bible, but I felt that these two were ones that made sense here. And they're references to biblical texts or parables in the Bible that basically explain the badge of inferiority that black people and that gay people bear in history and today. So this notion that African-American people bear a badge of inferiority is something that we've heard in the civil rights movement and in litigation to address racism in this country, and that law can play an important role in removing that badge, that it's not something essential about blackness, it's not something that attaches necessarily to skin color or phenotype, but that it's actually a social stigma that's created through a history of racism and racist laws certainly reinforcing that history. Unfortunately, the badge of inferiority, the stain, as I call it, of inferiority that black people continue to live with has been much more difficult to remove than the stain or the badge of inferiority that gay people have been burdened with. That we are perverts, that we are sinners, that we are disgusting has certainly been a story dating back to Leviticus, certainly, or earlier, that gay people have heard, and indeed that the Supreme Court embraced not that long ago in the Bowers versus Hardwick decision that was decided in 1986. In those short years since 1986 to now, we have lifted that badge. that stain, that sense of homosexuality as being a shameful, disgusting kind of set of practices that ought to be criminalized and rendered as an illness, really. And marriage, I think, has played an important role in lifting or even rebranding homosexuality. Yet marriage remains an institution that is publicly perceived as a site of failure for African Americans, even though all of the evidence shows that there is great health in African American families. There's enormous resilience in African American families. Children are well loved by their fathers and their mothers and their grandmothers and their aunts in African
families. Extended families are rich there.
We still perceive that as a failure rather than a success. And to the extent that there are statistically fewer women, African American women who have children while married to their children's fathers, we don't attribute that largely to the crime of mass incarceration in this country. Instead, we cite dysfunction or even pathology in the black community. So there's been little, I think, that African Americans have been able to do to impress public policymakers and the public more generally that marriage and the family is a site of African American strength and survivorship. Yet gay people have been able to do that so quickly. And that's part of what the book tries to unpack, is why has marriage been such a successful rebranding mechanism for gay people, yet remains a site of failure and discipline.
You were amazed at the speed, so was I, truly amazed, and you call it a juggernaut. How do you explain it?
Well, it's something in which the larger society has an investment. I think many heterosexual people were starting to feel somewhat guilty that they were getting married and their same-sex couple friends were not. And so they saw themselves as having an investment in this campaign so that they, too, could get married without guilt. The campaigns were very well financed, largely because this is a very conservative demand. As I said earlier in the interview, gay people are not looking to blow up the institution of marriage. They're asking to comply with it and be disciplined by it and to participate in it fully. So in part, I think it's the conservative nature of it and the degree to which the gay community has been able to portray veterans, stamp collectors, people taking their kids to soccer games, just decent, regular old Americans who want to get married and just happen to be gay. Yeah. Unfortunately, most of those plaintiffs have been white. Not all of them, in fact, are, and I want to credit the ACLU and Lambda for actually assembling a pretty diverse group of people to represent this issue. But the media has not picked up on that diversity. And so the same-sex marriage movement has had a kind of racial endowment by the perception of it being a white movement that I think has helped it. And I think we in the gay community have an obligation to counter that misperception of who's in the gay community and who are the couples who want to get married.
Yeah, I remember when Mayor Bloomberg presided over the wedding of the head of the city council. A friend of mine who had been active in was the head of the Gay Activist Alliance back in 1969. And he saw that and he just shrieked and he said, "It's the wedding cake crowd."
Right. Well, we're calling it the wedding industrial complex at this point. And, you know, many states are advocating and advocates, too, that allowing same-sex marriage is going to be an economic boon for states that are going to now be hosting destination weddings and... I mean, think of the new people who are getting married who weren't before. I have a critique of that, too, but I do think there is an economic payoff for this.
We've been talking to attorney and professor and head of the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Catherine Franke, about her new book, Wedlocked, The Perils of Marriage Equality. Catherine, the book has just come out. I imagine there's going to be some launches here in New York City. Where could people go to celebrate with you this wonderful book?
Well, on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, the 18th, we'll be doing a panel up at Columbia at 4:30 in the afternoon with leading scholars of both gay rights and black civil rights. Patricia Williams, Mignon Moore, and Kendall Thomas and I will be on a panel discussing the issues in the book. Everyone is welcome. We'd love to see you there.
Again, the book's called Wedlocked, The Perils of Marriage Equality. how African Americans and gays mistakenly thought the right to marry would set them free. It's a wonderful book. We recommend it to everybody. We thank you, Catherine Franke, for being on Law and Disorder.
Many thanks, Catherine.
Well, thank you, Michael and Heidi. It's great to be with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Michael, I understand you were at the memorial for Liz Fink in New York City recently.
Yeah, last Saturday, November 7th, up at Union Theological Seminary, about 150, 200 people came. A lot of attorney colleagues, clients, supporters of the various movements she got involved in. Liz Fink was a great criminal defense attorney from New York City. She's best remembered for the work she began as a young woman when Attica happened back in 1971. Liz got involved when Nelson Rockefeller, who was running for president and who didn't want anything unseemly to happen in his state, ordered the retaking of the Attica prison when the prisoners took over the prison. And some 40 people were killed, including a number of guards, just shot. Wantonly murdered. And Liz was on the defense team for those prisoners charged with crimes. And then she brought an offensive civil suit against Rockefeller and the other state officials and prison officials who were responsible for these murders. And she litigated that suit.
Years.
Went back and forth to Buffalo, I don't know, I think 25 years.
Yeah, because it settled in the early 2000s.
Yeah, for
right.
$12 million.
Mm-hmm.
It was just extraordinary. She financed that suit on her Visa card. She was very much and broadly admired for her work on that and on many other things. So
she was a highly political attorney and a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild.
And we were able to tape the memorial. And we're going to play what her colleague, Attorney Bob Boyle, said about her. And we're going to play what Daruba, her client, she and Bob represented Daruba. He did 19 years in prison, former Black Panther. They got him out. We're going to play Daruba's speech, too. And then, a real treat, we have some clips of Liz speaking herself. Let's give a listen.
I love my parents. But Liz Fink and the gentleman to my left raised me. They certainly raised me as a lawyer. In 1978, I was a second-year law student working for another great lawyer by the name of Michael Ratner, who had brought a lawsuit on behalf of Daruba bin Wahad against the FBI and the New York City Police Department and the state of New York. You know, quite a crew. And charging that he was a victim of a frame-up under the FBI's counterintelligence program. And Michael basically turned the suit over to me. He said, you want to work on it? Go right ahead. Liz then worked across the street at 350 Broadway and had known Daruba for many years and because of her going up to the prisons and eventually, you know, came on to that case. And together we litigated this lawsuit. You know, for me, you know, I was so young then, you know, I mean, I didn't know that we weren't, you know, that we could win something like that. And nobody told us that. You know, Liz didn't have to be told. because as you saw and as other people said, she said, fight. The justice is in the fight. And eventually, after another, you know, almost a decade of fighting, this man walked out of prison on March 22nd, 1990. You know, and she, you know, but when I think of Liz, it's everything people have talked about, but so much of, you know, I shared office space with her for 15 years, so, you know, so got to know her really well, and she was a partner in many cases and a great friend. But I think of all the times we laughed, and sometimes not with help of some substances. Sometimes we just laughed. You know, Daruba, for 4 years, we had written him into the federal custody at the MCC downtown to work on the civil suit. And, you know, Liz was she taught me you had to be a full-service lawyer, not just doing the cases, but you were involved with the families, taking care, everything. So Daruba's birthday was coming up, and he was in the MCC. And, you know, all three of us had in common a love for food, I would say. So the food in MCC was and is terrible, pretrial detention. And Daruba loves his mushu shrimp and his lobster. So we said, we're going to have a party in the attorney room at MCC. Liz cooked up 7 pounds of lobster, mushu shrimps, and, you know, she was big-hearted, big in many ways. And lobster was put here. Lobster was put here. I won't tell you what I may have had on my person as well. And because we couldn't really broadcast this, you know, I had to help her get dressed with, you know, at 36 Plaza Street there. You know, that was done. And then, of course, some horrible perfume. Because, you know, Liz could cook, you know, and it was going to taste good and be spicy and be aromatic. You know, we went down to the MCC and, you know, she was her usual self going in, you know, and putting up her arms and with the metal detector. And let's just say we had a wonderful visit for his birthday. And there was another trial we did. You know, we sued the Department of Correction because they put him in solitary and other things. And we went to trial in this case in front of the Honorable Constance Baker Motley. And this was towards the end of Judge Motley's career. And Judge Motley, for people who don't know, was the first black woman appointed to the federal bench in the 60s. She was one of the lawyers on Brown versus Board of Education and was really a civil rights icon. And this case that we tried in front of her was kind of, she looked at it as a return to her roots, what she was doing. And, you know, Liz, people have said, you know, great presence in court. And, you know, it's something you really, she tried to help me do, but you really can't learn. And we had this Deputy Superintendent of Security, Wilhelm, was on the stand, who had framed him and put him in solitary, where he spent a couple of years. And he was under cross-examination. And this was a guy that Daruba, to his face when he was in prison, would call Deputy von Stupendorf. And Liz was cross-examining him, and it was about some issue of putting him in solitary. And Deputy Wilhelm said, you know, I did it because I did it. And was he, you're not going to answer the question? No, I'm not going to answer the question. And she looked at him, I'll never forget it, you know, and just said, this isn't your prison, Deputy Wilhelm. This is a courtroom. In here, I get to ask the questions, and you have to answer. Yay, Attorney General. Attorney General gets up. Objection, Your Honor. Judge Motley looks over. Overruled. And there were many moments like that I was proud to have shared. Thank you, Liz.
Good evening, everybody. There's so many faces in here that bring back so many memories of struggles and fights that we've been through. And it's good to see you again. But we're here for our comrade and my friend and yours, Liz Fink. Now, Liz wasn't just my attorney. She was my friend. And, excuse me if I get a little emotional. But I remember the first time I met Liz when she decided to take my case. I didn't ask her to take my case. She told me she was taking it. And she said, Umar told me to take your case. You're talking about one of the Attica brothers, Umar from the Attica brothers. He said, Umar said, and Umar was locking next to me in the box. And he used to go out to visits on a regular basis, and we used to talk. And Umar said, I'm going to talk to Liz about getting you an attorney. So he talked to Liz. Liz said, call me out on a visit, on a legal visit. And she said, I want to take your case. And from that moment on, for how long was it? Maybe 8 years?
10 years.
I was getting out of prison every week, every month, every year. And she would say, you know, you always getting out of jail. I could just get out the box. I said, you know, this is our year, Liz. And she said, yeah. Bob and Liz used to come up in snowstorms. Bob had a little old rinky-dinky car. What was it?
A Falcon.
They don't even make them no more. He had a little rinky-dinky car. The hood was tied down with string. And you know how the police are. They get a pleasure in transferring you to the furthest prison that they could in the middle of the night. And because I had a BLA stamp on my record, they used that as an excuse for security and said, we can't notify no one when we move him. And they moved me one time. It was in the dead of winter. It was a snowstorm. And they moved me all the way up to Clinton. And everybody knows Clinton, Dan O'Mara, because it snows upside down. Doesn't snow down. It snows up in Clinton. And they moved me about 2 o'clock in the morning. Snatched me out and moved me. So somehow one of the brothers in the cell block managed to get a call out later on that day and call Liz. And they moved me around and around the state all day long. And I arrived up at Dannemora at wee hours in the morning. And they were saying to me, well, you know, you're going straight to isolation. Now we got you back up here. What you going to do about this, that, and yada, yada, yada. So 7:30 in the morning, snowing outside, snow's about 8 feet deep. Here comes Liz with a show cause order. Woke the judge up. Your Honor, my client's life is in danger. He's over in Dannemora. I needed a show cause order signed so that we could have this. And the judge in his pajamas and his underwear and his night is just insane. And her and Bob came up in a snowstorm, in a blizzard, to Dannemora, 7:30 in the morning. And you should have seen the faces on the police. It was magic. They, you know, a frown turned upside down. Well, they had a smile turned upside down. They were bitter, cross as two sticks, and they, your attorneys are here to see you. You need to get dressed. And, you know, I strut out to the visiting room and go through all my changes, arrogant, humiliate them. But Liz was in my corner from that moment that Umar told her to take my case until the day she died. And I was in hers. And life seems a little different now with her gone. But the fight, that struggle, this struggle, you know, I tell Bob that, you know, I know you're not a member of in good standing with the NLG anymore, but they need to establish a workshop. They need to establish a body, an institution inside the National Lawyers Guild with Liz Fink's name to train new attorneys on how to be fighters. In that way, maybe, as this struggle amplifies, as we live through the last days of empire, a lot of us here are kind of, you know, down in the tooth. We are looking our mortality in the face, as they say, we're in the winter of our lives. And we might not see the end of empire. We might not see the end of this injustice of white supremacy and racism and the type of homophobia and sexism that we know have become institutionalized in this society and in this civilization. We might not see that end. But with a Liz Fink Institute in the National Lawyers Guild or a Liz Fink workshop or a Liz Fink training program, we could be assured of one thing, that her spirit will live on and that the fight against these forces will continue. And I want to say it was good in this life having Liz Fink as my comrade. Thank you.
We go now to the first of four clips of Liz Fink speaking that were played at the memorial.
We take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution against all enemies, domestic and foreign. Now, what we have done and what we did in this case was we preserve, protect, and defended the Constitution against domestic enemies. And the domestic enemies are the domestic enemies we have seen for the last 8 years and continue to see a little bit in Obama, and that's the American government. If you don't put your government to the task, if you don't make them follow the Constitution, then you get what we just got, which is 8 years of our Constitution being used as toilet paper. And it's the Constitution that makes us free, the First Amendment. And I want to thank everybody for coming here. Right, and if any of you are thinking about going to law school, what a thrill it is to defend the Constitution against the domestic enemy of the American government. I hope to do it until I die. The biggest compliment I ever got was when a prosecutor a few years ago accused me of jeopardizing the Republic. I am jeopardizing the Republic.
I never did what anybody wanted me to do. I was always ran a different way. So I was a red diaper baby, and I was brought up by communists. And I started Woodland in 1950, and I went till 1960. When I went to Camp Woodland, music became a big thing because that's what motivated me. So we just learned all these songs. Oh, a red-headed woman took me out to dine. She said, love me, baby, leave the Union behind. Get thee behind me, Satan. Travel on down the line. I'm a Union man. In seventh grade, I was called Khrushchev's daughter. Okay? I was famous for being leftist in high school. And while I inculcated what they believed, I didn't want to be a political person because my mother was nuts, right? But politically, you know, she was the most enlightened person of her age I ever met. I was taught that the struggle for black people, for freedom and justice in this country, was the most important thing I could be a part of, that it was my responsibility as a white person, right, to support and do everything I could. You know, I was taught that it's everybody's obligation to join the movement. When I went to Reed, you could have been involved in politics, but I chose student government instead. And I became a member of the community senate, head of the, and then I became student body president and head of the judicial board. And then I came out of Reed and my father died, which was a terrible thing for me, and I had to run his business. And my mother certainly didn't want me to run his business. My mother wanted me to be a leftist lawyer, and so she was going to facilitate that. But in August of 1968, me and a friend named Ken Linden drove to Chicago for the Democratic Convention. We were not there to demonstrate. We were there to watch. right? Now, of course, we were supportive of the demonstration, but, you know, I wasn't involved in any of that. Make a long story short, we're caught up in this thing, and it's 8:06 at night on the corner of State and Grant, and I'm right there. And I look at the cops, and they go, "You ready?" Right? And they charged. Right, first of what happened is they had one charge, and then the second charge, Sidney Peck walked over to them, who was the leader of the demonstration, and was gesticulating, "What did you just do after you were beating everybody?" And they beat him to a pulp down there and dragged him away. And then everybody started, there was this police riot. Okay, so at 8:06 p.m. on August 28, 1968, I became a different person, because then my whole thing kicked in about, you know, being the child of Jews right after Nazism, and when you have this kind of thing, you've got to fight it, right? And as a result of that, I became an active principal and full-time leftist. I applied to Brooklyn Law School on about August 15th for the September 15th term. And I said, well, if they'll let me in, I'll go. And if they don't, well, I guess I won't go to law school. And I had done fabulously on my law boards. And Brooklyn Law School was a gut school. The minute they saw those scores, they wanted them. So off I went to Brooklyn Law School. I had gone to law school, but I had chosen the revolution many years before, right? So I went to law school to represent people who took radical action. And I got to do that. I got admitted to practice law in New York on May 6, 1974. And on July 4th, 1974, I put my dog in the car, and with two friends who were involved, I drove to Buffalo, New York. I had told them that I would give 2 weeks of my time, because I borrowed my mother's car and put the dog in the car, right? When I graduated from law school, you know, I just wanted to be a criminal lawyer. I wanted to support the movement, right? And what else could you do? But ABLD was it. I got up there on July 4th, and on July 5th, I walked into the office at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was commandeered by Frank Big Black Smith, who interviewed me for an hour, and then by Dennis Cunningham, and I fell in love with both of them. And so that was it.
It was Smith who convinced Fink to take on the civil case, one no other lawyer would touch. Over the course of more than 25 years, the two worked side by side, maneuvering through the legal system. For Fink, the suit was exactly the kind of case that had made her become a lawyer.
I wanted to be a lawyer because I wanted to fight the state. And there was no better case to fight the state about, right, in a legal means than Attica. Because what they did there was so outrageous and so terrible that they had to be held accountable for it. And I decided, and Frank decided, and the rest of us decided, that we were going to hold them and make them accountable and make them pay for what they did, or we would die trying. And we would not give up. And so we did not give up. And so we won.
You know, the thing that I had that most people lose sight of is that I had a goal, and I wanted a result. That's what I want. I want to win. I don't want to make my point. Oh, no, no, no. Right? Yeah, I want to make my point. You know, I'm allowed obnoxious egotist just like everybody else, but that's irrelevant. It's not going to do me any good in the long run. What's going to do me good is to win, to get what I want. Yes. And it's the fight, right, for that kind of justice that keeps us even better than what we would be if we just let ourselves just do it, right?
Unity in the yard. Everybody working together. Attica is all of us, but Attica means fight back.
You know, if you make a commitment to be a political person and to believe in a progressive vision, then you have to live that. You know, and that's what people don't do. They just talk it. And then when push comes to shove, you know, they don't live it. Well, we try and live it.
Liz is a litigator. Liz is a fact finder. Liz likes to fight. Staying in your face. Making you work the law and working the law. Making you respect it. Making you make it work. Making you be accountable.
After 25 years, we either had to take the $12 million offered or continue our fight where there was a real possibility that we wouldn't get a dime before most of the plaintiffs died. What would have been justice? Very simple. To indict the murderers, to impeach Nelson Rockefeller, and to award significant compensation immediately to the victims. That would have been justice. This case was a hell of a case. We worked on it for a long time, and we thank everybody for the tribute that everybody has given us, but we have to say this. What we got might have been a victory, but it was not justice. Who they were, a bunch of black, Puerto Rican, people of color, rebellious convicts, was more important to the system than the Constitution and the concept of justice. And so we did not get justice. No justice at all. No justice for anybody. So you ask, well, if there's no justice, why do we do this? And the answer to that is because there's a struggle for justice. And the struggle for justice is what makes this meaningful and what makes life meaningful. Many, many young people were with me. Some of them, I'm looking at it in the room today, with me, who are still here, who gave themselves to move to Buffalo, New York, and become staff people at Attica Brothers Legal Defense. And it wasn't that we were helping them. They were helping us. They changed our life. They impounded us because the Attica Brothers stood firm against the state. They stood firm with themselves, and they fought the state. They didn't give in, and what happened was there were 5 trials. We won 4 of them. There was a huge movement. We participated in it. We changed Buffalo, New York's jury project, and we created the paradigm which says that when you fight, that's what you do. There is no justice in America. What empowers you is the fight for justice.
Those were clips of Liz Fink that were played at her memorial.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.